I mentioned in the announcements I was going to go back into the subject of Christmas. Obviously, my mind is on it because I've spent so much time this week researching it and writing the bulk of the Christmas booklet that is now done as of yesterday, unless I add a few things over the weekend, which I suspect I will as a result of even more Christmas research this morning. But because my mind is on it, I thought I would give another sermon about the subject. There are any number of ways to approach this subject. Last year I gave a sermon about Santa Claus and proved that he was really the ancient god Moloch that is so intertwined with history, with Israel's history of idolatry and so forth. And a lot of that, by the way, is in the booklet. A lot of that emphasis, which made the booklet a bit longer, is there. Now, how bad is Christmas? How bad is Christmas? I've learned that one of the great tools Mr. Armstrong used, and nobody else ever used it, but I'm learning to use it, I think, more effectively as I copy and read his materials, is to ask questions. Every time I'm about to write, I'll just confess to you, I pick up something Mr. Armstrong wrote, almost anything, and just read for a while so that I can get the sense of this tremendous style and skill that he had honed and that God blessed further so that I can sort of think and write maybe halfway as good as that. And one of the greatest gifts Mr. Armstrong ever had, and he used it over and over, was using a series of questions. You can virtually pick up any booklet or any article that he ever wrote, and he will open in a kind of a promotion on the inside cover of the booklet with a series of commonly asked questions about the subject. Certainly, you open the Christmas booklet over there on the rack, and you pick it up, and you'll see how he did it. I'm not allowed to use the exact same language for copyright reasons. I can't do it. So I have to start with the very best way to say something and then say, well, I can't say it that way. I've got to say it some other way. Try to do that sometime. It's hard. But I can follow certain styles that he used, and one of them is a series of questions. How bad is Christmas? And is it really that bad? And if it is, if so, in what way is it bad? I'm going to tell you, there isn't much about Christmas that feels bad when you're doing it. There isn't much about Christmas on the surface that looks bad when you view it. There isn't much about Christmas music that sounds bad when you hear it. What's so bad about it? Some of you either already have or soon will walk through a mall in the rest of the Christmas season. Christmas is, about 23 days away, 3 weeks from this Monday. The brethren around the world, if they're going to hear this sermon before Christmas, I need to give it 2 weeks earlier for you than them. That's why I'm giving it now. They'll hear it on the 16th, the week I'm going to give the sermon about Inside the Work. And I want them to hear it before Christmas, because walking around in a mall is its own education. You see the colors. They're so bad about red and green. We just produced a booklet that's not really green, but it's sort of teal. Mr. Armstrong produced a booklet, Ending Your Financial Worries. It's the only booklet I think he ever wrote that was green, and it's about money, so I guess I have to assume that's why he chose to do that. A lot of things in life are red. Christmas is associated with red. Well, so are fire engines, and so's that sweater in the back row. Or, you know, that's not a sweater. But anyway, there's nothing wrong with the color red. When you see red and green together, it's beautiful. What could be bad about that? You see it all the time this time of year. There are people that put up lights, spectacularly beautiful lights. There are now companies that come and put up lights because some people want their house to look like Chevy Chase's in the movie Christmas Vacation, if you've ever seen it. It's a very funny movie. One lady put up 30,000 lights herself, and the TV cameras back in the mid-80s where I was pastoring came out to look at these lights, 30,000 of them. You know, some people want a major manger scene on their front lawn. Others want a group of kind of Christmas carolers standing there. Others want lights just on their house. Others want lights under trees. Some want lights on the bushes. Others want sort of the Santa and his reindeer, you know, Rudolph and, you know, Dancer, Prancer, Donner, and Vixen, and the others. They're in front of Santa's sleigh, and they want that scene on their lawn. This lady, I drove by to see it, had them all. She had every one of them. 30,000 lights. I told myself the only thing she didn't have yet was her light bill, and it may be the last year she ever did it. I don't know. I mean, Santa Claus is a beloved figure. I remember back in the mid-80s, as a matter of fact, out came a movie about Santa Claus being a mad axeman. And the movie was entitled Silent Night, Deadly Night. And this Santa Claus serial killer went around killing people with an axe. And boy, did Hollywood take it on the chin. You don't picture Santa Claus as a mad axe killer. As I recall, the movie was withdrawn. Now, it's all right if you picture anybody else a mad axe killer. No problem. No problem. People will go do that, but don't do it to dear old Santa, old Saint Nick, which, by the way, has long been a name for the devil. People don't know that. And so Santa looks pretty okay. Maybe he needs to lose a few pounds. Maybe he needs to trim his beard a little bit. But other than that, Santa looks okay. The lights are beautiful. The music is beautiful. If you're going to hear it much, you better get ready to fight the tendency to start humming it. Any of you? It's kind of like eating unleavened bread or leavened bread during the days of unleavened bread. At the last Holy Day, I ask people if they've done it, and there's usually, maybe 10% of the group will raise their hand. Those of you who've been in my pastorate for a few years know that I do that. Well, I might in a month ask you how many of you hummed Christmas tunes. Have any of you done it yet? My hand's up, because I had to catch myself. Just preparing, I even feel, for all those of you out in the other congregations, I'll just tell you that every single person's hand went up. They won't know if I'm telling the truth. No, they're about a third. How many again? Raise your hands. Oh, wow. About half, maybe a third. But anyway, people do that because it's unconscious. It takes them back to their past. Well, I don't know that I ever spent a Christmas during my teenage years where we didn't go singing Christmas carols through the neighborhood in front of my friends' houses. And my parents weren't particularly religious. They rarely went to church. Sometimes they went to Christmas and Easter services, and that's about it. I've told you in other sermons, they would often, my dad would get up in the morning, and after I was done with my paper route, he'd tell me I was going to church. He'd drop me off at church, drive away, sometimes sitting still in his pajamas in the car, and I'd have to go in, and I'd come back. At least he'd pick me up. He was out of his pajamas, and he would go back home, and he wouldn't go to church. And, I did that scores, maybe, I don't know how many times through my childhood. Always seemed a little strange. My parents never went in, but they wanted us to be churched. Well, on Christmas, they would often do the same thing. They weren't religious, but for some reason, they wanted us to sing carols through the neighborhood. So we did. And, of course, we always went to my friend's house, and none of them did it. None of them did it. And we'd be standing out there, and I'd have to stand there, you know, and I'm singing Christmas carols at their door, which is a custom, and they're supposed to open the door, and the neighbors all knew the packs were coming, and so we would be standing there, my brother and sister, me trying to hide at 6'5", or whatever I was at the time, and there'd be my friends peeking out the window over here, laughing. You know, I'd be singing Deck the Halls or whatever, and I wanted to go in and deck them. But I had to do it, and then, you know, in we go, and immediately I had to kiss my friends' mothers under the mistletoe, because that's one of the first things you do. And, oh, yeah, that's pagan, by the way. Not just the mistletoe, but doing it early in the evening. Gets the revelry going. gets the festive orgy-like spirit up and running. But of course, people don't know that today. And I certainly didn't have that in mind when my friends would also giggle when their mothers would pull me under, and my brother, and you know, my younger brother and older sister, and we had to kiss under the mistletoe. But what could be so bad about singing Silent Night? Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Are holly wreaths all that bad? I mean, what's wrong with a Christmas dinner? You're going to eat dinner somewhere. And of course, Jim Carrey's got a movie out this year about the Grinch. He's a funny guy, and I'm sure it's going to be a funny movie. There's children's stories on TV, and it goes back to the 30s, and all of those movies will be played this year, as they are every year. Lots of them with stories and plot lines that kind of pull on the heart. And what could be so bad? You all have memories of Christmas. Now, there are a lot of bad fruits to Christmas, and I talk about that in the Christmas booklet, which by the time most of the rest of the brethren here will have already gotten the booklet, and maybe they'll have read it by the time they hear this sermon. Certainly going through them all, I can tell you that you will see lavish decorations and what's called merchandising designed to get people to buy, because most of you know that roughly 55, maybe 60% of all of the retail sales that occur every year in this country happen during the quote-unquote Christmas shopping season. And there's lots of snow in the window scenes, and there's lots of red and green, and of course a lot of tinsel, a lot of glitter. And I often think how the devil, who has deceived the whole world, has done it in this worst season of the year. When you understand what it's about, he has conned the whole world with a giant sack of tinsel. Because the beauty of this world is about as deep as tinsel, which isn't very deep. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Every year, ministers should be studying certain things seasonally. I will tell you that I did not hear many sermons on Christmas, didn't hear of other men who gave them. This morning I listened to a sermon I gave on December 15th, 1984 on the subject of Christmas, and I just was thinking, and it hadn't struck me, I don't remember hearing many ministers cover the subject of Christmas. And then it made me realize, you know, going back and preparing this myself and remembering things that I've studied on the subject of Christmas, and I'll go so far as to say, I hope nobody thinks I'm bragging. I don't mean it to brag. I mean it in a way to show you that I've even been able to learn on this subject. I suspect I probably studied the subject of Christmas more than any minister other than perhaps Mr. Armstrong. And I hope you don't take that as bragging, because my point is to say, and I've studied and studied and studied it for years. That's why to write a long booklet on it was not particularly hard. But just going back and reviewing and getting ready again for both this sermon and the booklet that got finished this week, I realized all over again some things that can even drift out of my mind on the subject. I wrote an article about Christmas, a long article about Christmas, when I was back in Global. It was very strong. And oh, by the way, I got taken to task by the leader, who chewed me out 5 separate times because my article on Christmas was too strong. Each time he saw me, over a period of 5 times, he said it was too strong. So just so I would be sure that I didn't get the point, I made this booklet even stronger. So I'll tell you that much right now. I'm having a little fun with it, but I'll tell you, this booklet is unbelievably strong. Loads of quotes in it. And as I said in the announcements, I'm going to add some more tomorrow. Just because of preparation this morning, I decided I want some more things in it. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Verse 29, when the Lord your God shall cut off the nations from before you where you go to possess them, and you succeed them, and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself, that you be not snared by following them, after that they be destroyed from before you, and that you inquire not after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. You shall not do so unto the Lord your God, for every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, have they done unto their gods. For even their sons and their daughters, they have burnt in the fire to their gods. And last year, the sermon about Moloch, I went into great detail how the real origin, of course, of Santa Claus is the god Moloch. Santa Claus is the modern god Moloch, who most commonly was the god, in fact, that Israel kept burning their little babies to because they believed they should do it. God called it an abomination. What things soever I command you, observe to do it. You shall not add thereto, nor diminish from it. Well, of course, the world essentially says, we don't keep Christmas with the same ideas and focus in mind that the pagans did when they did the exact same customs that we use and now called Christmas, that they called the Saturnalia. We do it focusing on Christ. The problem is, that's not what God says to do. In vain do they worship me, God said, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men, making the commandments of God of no effect through their tradition. Christmas is a worldwide tradition of men that goes contrary to this verse and verses in Exodus 34 and 23 and Leviticus 24 and Jeremiah 10 and Leviticus 18 and 20 and Numbers 11 and I don't know how many other places, even others in Deuteronomy, where God said, do not mix what the gods of the land who were there, served by the people you are succeeding, do not mix their customs with the worship of me. Now in the world, they even have a term for this. There's a term for doing this. It's called syncretism. You know what synchronized swimming is. People say, let's synchronize our watches. That means merge them. Let's make sure our watches say the same time. Synchronized swimming means that everybody moves exactly in the same way. You've seen synchronized swimmers. It's a beautiful thing to see. You know, they go underwater at the same time. They stick their leg up at the same time. They move and pivot in the same way. It's beautiful. Except when you apply that to Christianity and paganism, and you synchronize the two, called syncretism, just take the word again, God says, it's not beautiful at all. It isn't what I want. Let me read an example of the Druids. How many of you know, or you've all heard of the term Druids? Most of you have. Let me read a quote to you about the ancient Druids. They were basically a priesthood. All of the Druids, really, were priests. I'm reading from the Encyclopedia Britannica under the subject Druids. The learned class among the ancient Celts, or Celts, C-E-L-T-S, the Celtics. Now, if I ask you, well, who are the Celtics? Most of you would say, well, a basketball team in Boston. Well, the basketball team in Boston were named after the Celtics, who were basically presided over by this priesthood called the Druids, whose name means knowing or finding the oak tree. That's what Druid means. A Druid, if you talk about a Druid, you're talking about one who knows or finds oak trees. That's interesting. They seem to have frequented oak forests, where they made groves. God talked about people who served groves. We'll see a little bit more about that later on. And they acted as priests, teachers, and judges. And the earliest known records of the Druids from the 3rd century B.C. I'll tell you who the greatest authority in the world is on the Druids. Believe it or not, Julius Caesar. Much of what we know about the Druids was recorded by Julius Caesar. And he's the principal source of information, not the only one. There were two groups of men in Gaul that were held in honor, the Druids and the noblemen, called the Equites, which means the equals. Caesar related that the Druids took charge of public and private sacrifices, and many young men went to them for instruction. The Druids' principal doctrine was that the soul was immortal and passed at death from one person to another. They were, if not the authors of, they really were not the authors of the doctrine of the immortal soul, but they were certainly the ones who made the doctrine more well known. They also taught young men astronomy, natural philosophy, and the power of the gods. The Druids offered human victims for those who were gravely sick or in danger of death in battle. Now here's what they would do. They would build giant wicker baskets as big as this room, fill them with logs, and then they would put human beings in there and burn them to death. That's what they would do. And I could go on and read more about that right from this column in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now what they would do typically is they would go down to the local jail and see, you know, how many prisoners were there and say, we'll start with these, but if it wasn't enough, then they would start calling volunteers, not volunteers, I'm being facetious, and people would willingly offer their little children in a fashion that was exactly what Israel had done hundreds of years before. They would offer their children and sacrifice along with the criminals these innocent victims, if necessary, to hit certain numbers. And you will find that they basically cleared places in the forest, and they would have their services, their ceremonies, and their rites done in that way. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 10, if you would, please. Jeremiah chapter 10. As I said in the booklet on Christmas, no booklet on the subject of Christmas would be complete unless you had Jeremiah 10, because no booklet would be complete on that subject unless you talked about the Christmas tree, and it's mentioned here. Let's read in verse 3, Jeremiah 10 and verse 3. Well, we're kind of forwards, then backwards, then jump ahead here in this chapter. For the customs of the people are vain. For one cuts a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. I remember being thunderstruck, like I'd been hit with a sledgehammer when I first read this back in the mid-60s. Here it is, right there. They fasten it with nails and with hammers that it move not. You see, you can't turn to most of the other things that have to do with Christmas, holly wreaths, mistletoe, Yule logs, Santa Claus in a direct way, and you can, certainly Santa Claus is mentioned in the Bible when you understand he was Moloch, but you cannot turn and find direct references to those things because they never were part of the mind of God. The people have long put up Christmas trees. Jeremiah wrote basically about 600 years before Christ. Actually, it took him about 40 years to write his book. He started writing in 615 and finished about 625, and finished writing about 585. So we'll say roughly 600 BC is when Jeremiah was written. And here there's a warning, don't do this because people did it. Now, some later in the Worldwide Church of God, false leaders who came in began to say, well, these were just totem poles. This isn't a talking about trees. This is talking about totem poles, and don't make idols. This is a warning against idols, idol worship. And of course, they went on and brought in all kinds of art and idolatry. But when it came to okaying the Christmas tree, they said this is talking about idolatry. When it came to allowing idolatry, this is the hypocrisy of false leaders, then they began to say, well, it's just art. And if you say, well, it's art, then you say, well, there's always an explanation. But I will never forget how they just dismissed Jeremiah 10 as so much totem polery, I guess. They deck it with silver, with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers that it move not. I remember putting up the Christmas tree many times. They're upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be born. That doesn't mean give birth to them. It means to be carried. You know, airborne express means, you know, air carried express. Because they cannot go. They can't walk by themselves. Be not afraid of them. They'll say, oh, that means it's no big deal. So they cannot do evil. So there's no problem. Neither also is it in them to do good. That's not what it's saying. We'll see that in a moment. For as much as there is none like unto you, O Lord, you are great, and your name is great in might. So is it okay to put them up? Verse 2. Thus says the Lord. This is what really leads into it. Learn not the way of the heathen. Now, brethren, I don't think any other groups. I could be wrong. And I really, if I'm wrong, I'll gladly say I'm wrong. I don't know of any other groups that have written a booklet on Christmas anymore. I mean the groups that are standing up for the truth. Of course, I don't know any that have written a booklet about the devil either. Some of them have booklets about the gospel who are doing the work. Those are the three booklets we have so far. But when you study Christmas, you're studying the devil. When you're studying the devil, you're studying Christmas. And most of the other groups, those are strong, important, all-encompassing, overarching doctrines. They're bigger than they look. It's one reason why the booklets were bigger when I wrote them than I thought they would be. So I don't know that anybody is even saying these things anymore, at least not in writing. Learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven. Yeah, about 25% of all Americans read their horoscope every day. Why? Because they're dismayed at the signs of heaven. That's why they do it. God says don't, so they do. For the heathen are dismayed at them. Well, that means at least 25% of Americans, I'm sorry, this is what God says, are heathen. I'm not calling them heathens. I'm saying that's what the Bible says. And then it goes into the discussion of the tree. Why do people do this? Because in verse 23 it says, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walks to direct his steps. Now many people out in the world understand the origin of Christmas. In going through the preparation of this booklet, I just went back through a lot of newspaper articles I had cut out, as well as the Encyclopedia Britannica and Encyclopedia Americana and various other Bible dictionaries and different sources, including Josephus and others. Make no mistake, we couldn't quote these sources about the origin of Christmas if they weren't available, which means people took the time to record where Christmas comes from. I'm going to be quoting a number of quotes here as the sermon develops. And they can be quoted because it's known. It's known. I remember sitting down with my uncle a couple, now maybe 4 or 5 years ago. He had sent us the Encyclopedia Britannica 1958 edition, and I had studied the subject of Christmas, looked it up, and had a staggering amount of material. Of course, the 11th edition, back in the early part of the century, has the most on the subject of Christmas and many other things, the subject of Easter. I'm probably about three-quarters done with a booklet entitled The True Origin of Easter, too. It's going to be a very strong booklet, and that's rolling along very nicely. You can't study Christmas without studying Easter. You can't study Easter without studying Christmas. And I was just reviewing my notes on Easter the other day because I'm going to cover some points right here on the subject of Easter. But, you know, you start studying those things, and I will tell you, you see an overlap. You absolutely see an overlap, and you recognize that the Britannica today, if you get the edition today, chops out a tremendous amount of this. And I told my uncle, who, as you all know, pretty much built Encyclopedia Britannica, and I said, how come Encyclopedia Britannica back in the 58 edition has all of this background exposing Christmas bare for the absolute pagan holiday that it is, and now the modern Encyclopedia Britannica chops most of it out? He said, I didn't know they did. I didn't know they did. It was about the time, I guess, maybe a little bit after he had retired, and they've done it. They're adding other things, and you can only make Britannica big as it is, only so big. But the world knows, and the world turns away. They do not claim it as the birth of Christ. Yet they use the birth of Christ as the very reason to justify keeping it. And the world has been buffaloed by Satan with a sack of tinsel. You know, speaking of buffalo, a lot of things aren't what people think they are. The song, Buffalo Gals, Won't You Come Out Tonight? How many of you know that song? Buffalo Gals, Won't You Come Out Tonight? Won't You Come? You know what that was? That was a song that the guys on the Erie Canal sang when they'd gone from Albany to Buffalo, and they got to Buffalo, and they wanted the whores out. And so, Buffalo Gals, we're coming in on the flatboats in the Erie Canal. Won't you come out tonight? We're tired. And that's where the song came from. Now, nobody sings, Buffalo Gals, Won't You Come Out Tonight, with the idea of a bunch of Erie Canalmen who are looking for whores. But that's exactly where the song came from. I'm sorry. When you look into the origin of things, it does change them. And I suspect most of you won't be humming, Buffalo Gals, Won't You Come Out Tonight, much more. I meant to read something to you at the beginning, so I'm either going to read it now or never get to read it, but I wanted to show you can even see some humor in the subject of Christmas, but I'm going to prove to you scientifically that Santa Claus doesn't exist. Is there a Santa Claus? An engineer's perspective. Consider this argument. Number one, no known species of reindeer can fly. We're going to have some fun here. But there are 300 million species of living organisms yet to be classified, and while most of these are insects and germs, this does not completely rule out flying reindeer, which only Santa has ever seen. Okay, now this is supposed to be a scientific engineering perspective. Number two, there are 2 billion children, persons under 18 in the world, but since Santa doesn't seem to handle the Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, or Buddhist children, that reduces the workload to 15% of the total. That's 378 million, according to Population Reference Bureau. At an average census rate of 3.5 children per household, that's 91.8 million homes. One presumes there's at least one good child in each. Number three, Santa has 31 hours of Christmas to work with thanks to the different time zones, the rotation of the earth, assuming that he travels from east to west, which seems logical. This works out to 822.6 visits per second. This is to say that for each Christian household with good children, Santa has 1,000th of a second to park, hop out of the sleigh, jump down the chimney, fill the stockings, distribute the remaining presents under the tree, eat whatever snacks have been left, get back up the chimney, get back into the sleigh, and move on to the next house. Assuming that each of these 91.8 million stops are evenly distributed around the world, which of course we know to be false, but for the purposes of our calculation we will accept, we are now talking about 78 miles per household, a total trip of 71.5 million miles, not counting stops, to do what most of us must do at least once every 31 hours, plus feeding, etc. This means that Santa's sleigh is moving at 650 miles per second. 3,000 times the speed of sound. For purposes of comparison, the fastest man-made vehicle on Earth, the Ulysses space probe, moves at a pokey 27.4 miles per second. A conventional reindeer can run, tops, 35 miles per hour. Number four, the payload of the sleigh adds another interesting element. Assuming that each child gets nothing more than a medium-sized Lego set, that's 2 pounds, the sleigh is carrying 321,300 tons, that would be 600 million pounds of weight, not counting Santa, who is invariably described as overweight. On land, conventional reindeer can pull no more than 300 pounds, even granting that reindeer, C.1, could pull 10 times the normal amount. We cannot do the job with 8 or 9 reindeer. We need 214,200 reindeer. This increases the payload, not counting the weight of the sleigh, to 353,000 tons. Now, number five, 353,000 tons traveling at 650 miles per second creates enormous air resistance. This will heat up the reindeer in the same fashion as spacecraft are entering the Earth's atmosphere. The lead pair of reindeer will absorb 14.3 quintillion joules of energy per second each. In short, they will burst into flame almost simultaneously, exposing the reindeer behind them, creating deafening sonic booms in their wake. The entire reindeer team will be vaporized within 4 1/4 thousandths of a second. Santa, meanwhile, will be subjected to centrifugal forces 17,500 times greater than gravity. A 250-pound Santa, which seems reasonable, will be pinned to the back of the sleigh by 4,315,000 pounds of force. Conclusion by this scientist: if Santa ever did deliver presents on Christmas Eve, he's dead now. Okay, so you can have fun with it, but it's a funny way to look at the Christmas lie that is told to children. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 7 now. Let's turn back a couple pages. We'll pick it up in verse 8. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit, God says. Will you steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, and walk after other gods whom you know not? And then come and stand before me in this house. Does this sound like focusing on Christ while keeping the Saturnalia, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations? Let me put it another way. Classic Protestant thinking: we're under grace. As long as you focus on Jesus, you can do anything. I know a group of people in Pasadena who think exactly that way. Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, says the Lord. But go you now unto my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these works, says the Lord, and I spoke to you, rising up early and speaking, but you heard not, and I called you, but you answered not, therefore will I do unto this house, which is called by my name, wherein you trust, and unto the place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I've done to Shiloh, talking about a second captivity. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast out all your brethren, even the whole seed of Ephraim. Therefore, pray not for this people. It's talking about modern Israel. God says, don't pray for them. Pray that God will call some out of them, but don't pray for them. Neither lift up cry nor prayer for them. Neither make intercession to me, for I will not hear you. Now, this is God talking to Jeremiah and talking to everybody else who hears. See you not what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead their dough to make cakes. We would call them hot cross buns, and they were done at Christmas time and at Easter, to the Queen of Heaven. Now I'll stop there for a moment. I'll never forget, first and second grade, my teacher's name was Mary Bush, just like President Bush, and perhaps next to be President Bush. And she was an old lady, and in my grade school, you had the same teacher for first and second grade. They felt that stabilized the kids more. So she had both first and second grade do this, and every year you had to stand up in front of the class and sing a song. And I remember, I was 6 years old, and I remember being absolutely terrified. I had to do it again in the second grade in front of Mrs. Bush, and I had to sing a song. And you could pick any song you wanted, and everybody in the class had to do it. You pick any song you wanted, and I'd turn through this thing of songs. Just, I was terribly, painfully shy and skinny and big, even in the first grade. And I thought, oh, my, I didn't want to do that. And so I picked Hot Cross Buns. It was the shortest song in the book. I can still remember it. Hot Cross Buns, Hot Cross Buns. Most of you probably sang it. One a penny, two a penny, Hot Cross Buns. I see some people lip-syncing out there, so you know the song, too. But anyway, that's what this is talking about. I had no idea when I was singing this song that was, I picked it was short, period. That's the reason that I was singing about cakes made to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods that they may provoke me to anger. That's what they do. Do they provoke me to anger, says the Lord? Do they not provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold my anger and my fury shall be poured out upon this place, upon man and beast, and the trees of the field and the ground, and it shall quench and shall not be burn, it shall not be quenched. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, put your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and eat flesh. Now, I've explained this before, but I'll just say it again. That's a Hebrew idiom. Today, it's the equivalent of saying, go jump in the lake, or get lost. If you said to somebody, go eat flesh, it means go stuff your mouth full of flesh so you can't talk anymore. That's what it means. Go eat flesh. Go jump in the lake. But God is using the words. God says, you take your offerings and your sacrifices and you go jump in the lake with them. That's exactly what it means. For I spoke not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. That's not what's important to me. That came later. But this thing I did command them, saying, obey my voice. Your sacrifices don't mean anything to me. If you mix sacrifices made to the Queen of Heaven, and you say, we're allowed to do all this because we're presenting them to God. It's a sacrifice to God. God says, sacrifices are not primary to me. Sacrifices only have meaning if they're done the way I say to do them, and everything that I say to do is what I mean by obey my voice. So don't mix the two. Obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. That's what makes us the people of God. And walk you in all the ways that I have commanded you that it may be well with you. But they listened not, they hearkened not, nor inclined their ear, but walked in the counsels and in the imagination of their evil heart, and went backward and not forward. Israel's always done that. It's not strange that spiritual Israel would do the same thing, brethren. Ancient Israel always went backwards. They'd be on track, they'd go backwards, God would take them into captivity, they'd cry out, he'd raise up a judge, pull them out of captivity, they'd walk softly and humbly for a while, then they'd go backwards again, they'd be taken into captivity, cry out, raise up a judge. We just described a lot of the Old Testament right there. It took about 30 seconds. But you know what? Spiritual Israel is exactly the same. Called out of this world, they fell backwards into the exact same things in the exact same way Jeremiah 7 said, don't do it. Don't learn the way of the heathen, Jeremiah 10 and Jeremiah 7, verse 30. For the children of Judah have done evil in my sight, says the Lord, for they set their abominations in the house, which is called by my name, to pollute it. And they've built the high places of Tophet, that means the drum, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, that's Gehenna, the sons of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire. We covered this last year in the Moloch Santa Claus sermon, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my heart or my mind. Never entered my thought, my mind, that people could think they were obeying me and burn up little kids. Therefore, behold, the days come, says the Lord, that it shall no more be called Tophet, that means the valley of the drum. If you remember a year ago, they beat the drums real loud to drown out the shrieks of the children who were burning in the fire after they smashed their heads on these idols, and then the parents who were shrieking because their baby didn't die right away when they sacrificed them, so they played drums real loud to kind of drown it out, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom. Don't call it that, but call it, in effect, but the valley of slaughter, for they shall bury in Tophet till there be no place, and that day is yet coming. Of course, turn over to Ezekiel 8 now. It talks about, this is a fascinating chapter, and the Easter booklet will cover much of it. I certainly want to have that out. I'm not going to rush that one out as fast, but it's probably better to have come out in March. I don't know, maybe I'll do it sooner since it's not that far from done. But Ezekiel chapter 8 and verse 5. Ezekiel 8 and verse 5. Then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now the way toward the north. Ezekiel 8, 5. So I lifted up my eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry. Well, that was Tammuz. If you look over at verse 14, they're weeping for Tammuz there. That's Nimrod, the sun god. Tammuz means to be make perfect by fire. Then said he unto me, I'm sorry, let's go back to verse 6. The image of jealousy, this idol. Then said he unto me, verse 6. He said that furthermore unto me, Son of man, see you what they do? Even the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here, that I should go far from my sanctuary, but turn you yet again, and you shall see greater abominations. Now, this is written in about 591 B.C., overlaps with with Jeremiah. He said, you're going to see as we move along, there was you see how bad this is? Well, I'm going to show you something worse. Then we keep reading. It's, well, you see how bad this is? I'm going to show you something even worse. This is the way the chapter develops. See how awful this is? Well, now I'm going to show you something even worse, and this is the way the chapter develops. And he brought me to the door of the court, verse 7. And when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. Then said he to me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I digged in the wall, behold, a door. And he said unto me, Now go in, and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing and abominable beasts and abominable, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel. And in the midst of them stood Jezaniah, the son of Japhan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Then said he unto me, Son of man, have you seen what the ancients, the leaders, the ones who were supposed to know of the house of Israel do in the dark and what they're teaching people? Every man in the chambers of his imagery, where they make idols? For they say, The Lord sees not, the Lord has forsaken the earth. Kind of like the front page of Time magazine in 1967. Is God dead? Remember that? Who would ever forget it, who was alive at that time? He said also unto me, Turn you yet again, and you shall see greater abominations. Here we go again, that they do. Then he brought me to the house of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Of course, that was, as I said, Nimrod, or the sun god, the fire god, the type of the you know, Saturn. Remember, I think it was a year ago I mentioned this in the sermon, that Saddam Hussein named his best missile the Tammuz. That's what he called it. And of course it means, Tammuz means to make perfect with fire. We went through all of that last year. I won't go back into it, but certainly Saddam Hussein was under no illusions what Tammuz meant. When you put that name on a missile, that missile, when it explodes, brings lots of fire. He knew exactly what it meant. I mean, nothing's changed 2,600 years later. Then said he unto me, Have you not seen this, O son of man? Turn you yet again, and you shall see greater abominations than these. And he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, and they worshipped the sun toward the east. That's what's on the cover there of the Easter booklet on the third line, you know, Easter sunrise services, which a lot of what may have been, or at least were a part of, spiritual Israel, the church, are now back doing again. They have truly gone backward, and they worship the sun toward the east, very much a part of common Easter sunrise services. Then he said to me, Have you seen this, O son of man? Is this a light thing to the house of Judah? Is this no big deal as long as you focus on Jesus, that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their, shouldn't be there, the Hebrew is to my nose. Now the branch comes from the Hebrew word Asherah. Asheroth is related to it. Asherah, A-S-H-E-R-A-H, and it means an obelisk. In blunt terms, it was the male sex organ carved out of wood, and they would wave it in front of God. It's a type of the sex organ of Nimrod, who, when he died, supposedly was cut off, thrown into the backyard, and up popped an evergreen tree. You know, when you mix in the history of Babylon and Egypt and Mesopotamian traditions, you'll find that is inseparable, absolutely inseparable from all of their thinking. And of course, Israel was there. They got into it. They followed what the gods all around them did. That's what they did. I may have told you this story, but my grandfather was an architect. Actually, was not an architect. He was a builder. One of his companies was a construction firm, and he built big buildings. He built most of the fraternity houses on most of the Big Ten universities that are still there today. One of his companies did that, and he built some churches. And I can still remember sitting in the back seat when it was my mother's father, was, we were stopping in front of a church, and he said, Jane, my mother's name, she said, if only they knew what that steeple meant. Now, my grandfather never went to church. I'll explain in a minute why. I don't ever remember him going to church, and my mother really didn't either any more than my dad did. I'll come back to that, but I mean, he said, if only they knew. He knew what the steeple stood for. It's a modern Asherah. The whole shape of churches built up to 100 years ago, and they're still this way, all through New England. But the steeple and the basic shape is the entire male sex organ. That's what it is. I mean, there's no mystery to it. Today, a lot of modern churches are kind of shifting away from that because they know it. So they're going to more modern architecture, but they still get a little steeple in there somewhere with a cross on the top of it, which, of course, is a fertility symbol. My grandfather knew that much, and he wasn't even in church. He had a favorite older brother, Donald. My grandfather was about 10, and his older brother, Donald, who was 12, and they were Christian Scientists when he was growing up. He had a fever, and his Christian Science parents, so I guess this would be my great uncle if he had lived, had this fever, and his parents were Christian Scientists. They wouldn't call a doctor, so you know, my great uncle Donald died at 12, and it devastated my grandfather, who was pals with him, and you know, he never recovered from it in his mind. That's it. Made a decision at age 10. He was never going to church, and when he died, he never had, I guess. But he understood that much. Verse 18. Therefore will I also deal in fury. I mean, God is not pleased when people wave steeples, branches, asherahs in his face. And that's exactly where all the steeples point. They point up. My eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. There is punishment coming because of these abominations. Let me read some other different traditions to you. From the Encyclopedia Britannica, under the subject of Rome, the survival of Roman religion, actually under Christianity, but the subhead, the survival of Roman religion. For a time, coins and other monuments continued to link Christian doctrines with the worship of the sun, S-U-N, to which Constantine had been addicted previously. But even when this phase came to an end, Roman paganism continued to exert other permanent influences, great and small. The emperors passed on to the popes the title of chief priest of the Roman system, and that title is Pontifex Maximus. You know where it comes from? Roman priesthood. The saints, with their distribution of functions, lots of different saints, and this was very common in the Babylonian religion that was shot through Roman custom. You know, you have Saint Christopher, Saint Bernard, Saint Andrew, Saint all different kinds. There really is a Saint Bernard. We were laughing about this morning. They're not all dogs. There's a Saint Bernard. And so, you know, people have Saint Christopher on their dashboard. He's the saint of the protection or something. Often seem to perpetuate the many details of ancient tradition. The ecclesiastical calendar retains numerous remnants of pre-Christian festivals. Now, here it is, right in the Britannica, notably Christmas, which blends elements including both the feast of the Saturnalia and the birthday of Mithra. That's the Iranian mystery god. But most of all, the mainstream of Western Christianity, look at this acknowledgement. Ode ancient Rome. This is Christianity. Ode ancient Rome. The firm discipline that gave it stability and shape. What a forthright admission to say Christianity owes a lot to Rome, because it's Rome who gave Christianity stability and shape, you bet. And they cite, most notably, Christmas. There it is. That's not from some obscure source. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings 18. Interesting verse here. Ahab was talking to Elijah. Verse 17, 1 Kings 18, are you he that troubles Israel? Elijah answered, I've not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house, and that you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and you have followed Baal, Baalim, shortened for Baal. Now therefore send and gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal 450, and the prophets of the groves 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. And Elijah came unto all the people and said, how long halt you between two opinions? Now this famous verse depicts Israel wanting so badly to appear to be and to be found by God to be sort of following the true God while following Baal, another name, by the way, for Nimrod, which we proved in other sermons. How long do you halt between two opinions? A lot of God's people are going to have to make some decisions along that line. I'm not talking about the ones who stayed behind and became Protestants or returned to Protestantism. I'm talking about a lot of people who sort of want to be found and thought to be holding fast fully, who aren't. Some people who left sent me a letter. These people just ferociously attacked us a year ago when they left Restored and wrote us a letter, just nice, newsy, chatty letter, and just, we haven't heard from you. I thought, what? You haven't heard from us? Don't you remember what you said a year ago? And just amazing. And then they sent us this literature from the group that they're with who believes the work is done. And they wanted us to see why they're never going to do the work again. Why it's over with. And they sent us this piece of literature. Well, a lot of people want to be found by God and they're thinking to be right, and they're not. The Lord be God, follow him. Now look at God's own words. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people answered him not a word, because they wanted to be between two opinions. They wanted to be found that way. Holding between two opinions is not something new 2,600 years later. God says, look, I'd rather you just go out and say, look, I am a Protestant, than to sort of hover between two. That's what God says to the seventh era, by the way. In a way, brethren, I actually have more respect in a certain way for the people who just said, look, Herbert Armstrong was all wrong. Of course, they're wrong. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just going to go right back to Protestantism. I'm not going to play games as though I'm holding fast when I'm really only going to hold fast to maybe two-thirds of the true doctrines. At least they're honest. At least those people aren't hypocritical. The people that are causing damage are many of the leaders and the people who are fooling others by saying they're holding fast, and you look at their doctrinal positions and they're not. And that's why I'm now working on this long list of doctrinal compromises. It's going to make a lot of folks mad. We're going to put it on our website, and it's going to be long. And it's only going to be the stuff that's being practiced in the various groups that claim to be holding fast. I don't know how many people will see it. I know a lot of people are talking about it and waiting for it who are not with us. It's going to step on a lot of toes. I want people to understand. I don't pull punches. By now you know I don't. I want people to know how much has been compromised and to see it. And there it'll be. It's going to sit on the first website that we have. And maybe a lot of people will look at it and answer not a word, but that's the way it's going to be. 2 Kings 17. And verse 7, 17:7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God. They were taken into captivity, in verse 4, the king of Assyria, of course, ancient Germany, which had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, back in verse 7, from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods. That was the problem. That's why God sends people into captivity. Verse 15, and they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity and became vain and went after the heathen. Usually when people get into new understanding, brethren, they call it new understanding. It may be the people back in the worldwide who called it new understanding. wow, we see new stuff. They're very vain about this junk that they think is new stuff. And that same attitude afflicts many people in a lot of the different groups out there. You know, we don't have any new knowledge to be vain about in Restored. Sure, we can understand doctrines that were restored by God through Mr. Armstrong better and better. No doubt about that. But we're not going to change anything. It's pretty hard to get puffed up. But when you start getting into other things, it's a funny thing how you become vain. A lot of people sneer at me who, Mr. Pack, can't you just grow? Can't you just see all these wonderful new ideas that the rest of us are able to grow onto? Can't you just get away from all that first grade Herbert Armstrong stuff? I mean, that's I almost get letters like that. And some of them very sincere. They just know that they've grown. They're just so filled with themselves. And you look at the doctrines that they've thrown out, and it's amazing. And they became vain and went after the heathen that were round about them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them, that they should not do like them. And they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made the molten images, even two calves, and made a grove, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire and use divination and enchantments and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with them and removed them out of his sight, and Israel has been lost ever since, brethren. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. Verse 20, and the Lord rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of spoilers until he had cast them out of his sight. God's focus is on the Middle East. It's not like God doesn't see the rest of the world, but that's where he's focused. That's where the land of Israel was. Verse 25, and so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Pretty serious. Pretty serious. Now let's look at some other quotes. I want to tie in some other different quotes. I have to move along here. I mentioned mistletoe. It's thought to have had special ritual significance in druidical ceremonies and lives in folklore today. Its special status, I'm quoting again from Britannica, as the Christmas mistletoe, having come from Anglo-Saxon times. Freely admitting where it came from. How about the holly wreath? The use of the holly plant dates back many centuries. By the way, mistletoe is a parasite. It can't live by itself. It lives on another host, and as soon as the host dies, the mistletoe dies. The use of the holly plant dates back many centuries. European pagans brought holly sprays into their homes, offering them to the fairy people of the forests as refuges from the harsh winter weather. Well, there's 26 different types of holly that you can buy in most nurseries. And they're beautiful. They have berries. I have a lot of holly plants. I planted a lot of them. And I have a lot of holly plants around. You know, nothing wrong with red and green. They're beautiful. They're prickly. Holly down south is different. Much bigger leaves and much longer thorns. But it's still beautiful to look at. There's different shades. You know, you have China boy and China girl holly. You have blue prince and blue princess. And blue boy and blue girl. I mean, I've studied holly as one who loves to plant them. And I know they even come in male and female varieties. You begin to understand why holly, unlike most other plants, comes in male and female. Blue boy, blue girl. China boy, China girl. Blue prince, blue princess. Can't have berries on the girls unless you got a boy around. If you plant them in your yard, you better have a boy 150 feet away from the girl. You can understand the sexual overtone at the Saturnalia, where revelry, drunkenness, and it turned into an orgy, why it would include this plant called holly. Because even holly comes in boys and girls. During the Saturnalia, the Roman winter, I'm reading again, festival, branches of holly were exchanged as tokens of friendship. The boys and the girls. The earliest Roman Christians apparently used holly as a decoration at the Christmas season. Fascinating. People have mixed Roman customs, Babylonian customs, with Christmas. What about December 25th? The traditional customs connected with Christmas have developed from several sources as a result of the coincidence of the celebration of the birth of Christ with the pagan agricultural and solar observances at midwinter. Well, what do you know about that? Just a coincidence. Still reading from the Britannica. In the Roman world, the Saturnalia, December 17th to 24th, was a time of merrymaking and exchanging of gifts. December 25th was also regarded as the birth date of the Iranian mystery god Mithra, the Sun of Righteousness. That was his name, the Sun, S-U-N, capital S-U-N. So it was very easy to just switch it over to the S-O-N of Righteousness. On the Roman New Year, January 1st, houses were decorated with greenery and lights. Sounds wonderful. And gifts were given to children and the poor. To these observances were added the German and Celtic Yule rites when the Teutonic tribes penetrated into Gaul. You know, the Yule law is basically from Teutonic or German nature worship. And Central Europe, food and good fellowship, the Yule log, the Yule cakes, greenery and fir trees, gifts and greetings all commemorated different aspects of this festive season. Fires and lights, symbols of warmth and lasting life, have always been associated with the winter festival, both pagan and Christian. There it is, I'm just reading. Since the Middle Ages, evergreens as symbols of survival, yeah, Semiramis threw her son's mail organ into the backyard, up popped a Christmas tree. As symbols of survival have been associated with Christmas. End of quote. The Christmas tree. The Christmas festival is the Christian revision of the Roman day of the winter solstice, the festival of Dies Invicti Solis, or the Day of the Invincible Sun, S-U-N, on December 25th. It slowly supplanted Epiphany, which originally was celebrated in the East on January 6th, as the birthday of Christ, as the manifestation of the heavenly Logos in the flesh. The fathers of the second and third centuries, such as Clement of Alexandria, Origen, and Epiphanius, contended that Christmas was a copy of a pagan celebration. They didn't want it. As the festival of the incarnation of the heavenly Logos, however, Christmas was increasingly entrenched in theology and liturgy under Roman influence. I mean, the early Catholic fathers didn't even want Christmas, but it slowly crept in during the struggle between Arianism and the 4th century. In Rome, the appearance of Christ, the Sun of Righteousness, S-U-N, from Malachi 4:2, was celebrated on December 25th in place of the Sol Invictus festival, which I just quoted, introduced by the Emperor Aurelian in the 3rd century as the festival of victory of Christianity over paganism. Fascinating. Turn to Revelation 17. Revelation 17. And verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come here, I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now, that many people, I guess a good whore, I put good in quotes, is going to have many Johns. And let me tell you, this whore has more Johns than any prostitute or harlot in history, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw, this is John, a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Yes, we'll have to write another booklet on this too. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great. I mean, you look at that religion and there are so many mysteries. So many mysteries. How you can go to hell and burn but never burn up. That's a mystery. I can have three in one. I can look at the face of God. Three beings and one God. I can look at the face of God but not see it. the beatific vision. That's a mystery. There's three mysteries just right there off the top of my head. Lots of mysteries. The mysteries of God, if you want to know the difference between the mysteries of Babylon the Great and the mysteries of God, very simply, Mr. Armstrong wrote a marvelous book called Mystery of the Ages. God has mysteries. Everybody loves a good mystery. But the mysteries of God all have explanations. The mysteries of the Babylonian religion remain mysteries to those who never look into where they came from. And then those who do that have done something the leaders of those mysteries don't want. You're not supposed to understand where they came from. The mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. Tremendous kind of astonishment, shock. Admiration, it said. Doesn't mean they admired them. You know, the Apostle John certainly didn't admire this whore. I'm sure you understand that. I mean, it's just sort of astonished, stunned at the sight of one woman who could command so many hundreds of millions of people. 800 million to basically a billion Catholics, somewhere in there, and somewhere around half to a billion Protestants. I hear numbers that range dramatically on Protestants. I've heard as low as 300 million. I don't think it's that low at all. I've heard others as much as a billion, and who knows where the math comes from. But that's a pretty effective woman. I mean, let's just be honest, brethren. I'm just trying to use God's own word, a woman who can service that many people. And that's exactly what God calls her, a great whore, a great harlot. The whole of the world system is wrong, and Christmas is part of it. You see this waddling old madam, it's kind of the way I picture her, who will fornicate with anybody. When safety came from Mussolini, she signed a concordat, which just means an agreement, and Mussolini would protect her. As soon as Mussolini was killed and his body stripped naked in the streets, she rushed over to Hitler and signed an agreement, a private agreement with Hitler. Then in came the Allies. The Allies found out about these things, and you know, and Mama Vatican rushed over. It's not as it seems. We were just trying to be friends with them so fewer Jews would be killed. You know, I've listened to all the rationale. I've read the voices of history. Turn to Hosea chapter 2. Hosea chapter 2. You know, the mother and child traditions are so common. I mean, you can go to China and there's a mother and child tradition. Most of the religions of the East, Hinduism has a mother and child tradition to it. The Babylonians, the Egyptians, various European traditions. Mithraism involved mother and child. Is it the song Silent Night that talks about mother and child? Well, it isn't Mary and Jesus. It just became very natural to refer to Mary and Jesus. Most of those same religions talk about a virgin birth as well. Hosea chapter 2. And we'll pick it up in verse 9. As soon as I get over there. Hosea 2 and verse 9. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof and my wine in the season thereof. Hosea 2, 9. And will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. God is going to strip his people. I mentioned this a little bit in the member letter yesterday. You know, God is stripping away the lovers of Israel, both the land of the Israelis and Israel today. It's humanly, it's frightening. I mean, for the people in the world, this is their government. And they see the whole ground moving under the world's feet. And people don't know what to make of it. They've never seen this before. And if the Supreme Court comes out with a decision 5-4 one way or another, then the Supreme Court. Now, a lot of people are saying you're going to look divided and partisan. and so many are watching the trembling going on in this country. And now, verse 10, will I discover the lewdness, the folly, her lewdness, in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand, as God strips away the lovers of Israel. Verse 11, I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, Christmas, Easter, Halloween, New Year's, Valentine's Day, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. People try to say, and we'll explain this when we get into the Holy Day booklet, that's obviously another one we have to write. People like to say, oh yeah, God doesn't want those holy days kept, and here's a verse. God always talked about my feast days, my holy days, my festivals. When he says hers, the Romans kept almost one out of every 3 days of any given calendar year. Almost one in every 3 days was celebrating something. Verse 12, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers, not God, have given me. And I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. And I will visit upon her the days of Baalim, wherein she burned incense to them. And she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels. And she went after her lovers and forgot me, says the Lord. Israel has copied this great madam, this great harlot of Revelation 17. Turn to Daniel 7, back a few pages. We'll read something. It is this great system, brethren, that has tried to change days and times and seasons. Daniel 7 and verse 25. Now, in the context, there is this reference, if we could go all the way through Daniel 7, it's talking about the little horn, the Pope, the Vatican, back in verse 8, this little horn there. And he shall speak, verse 25, great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. Now, that church and that system has persecuted the people of God for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and worn out a lot of God's people, killed them. And also, it says, and think to change times and laws. We used to talk about this verse, been a long time, but you hear much about it. They think to change times and laws. Decrees and laws of God, that's what laws mean. Change means to transform or alter. Fascinating. They think to transform and alter various times and decrees and laws of God. It's called syncretism. But keep the name of Christ. I have a quote I'd like to read. Back to Britannica. The Christian calendar is the most widely disseminated Christian institution, I'm quoting. The seven-day week and the rhythm of the Christian festivals have been accepted even by most of the non-Christian countries. Sounds like there's been a lot of impact on times and laws. Despite energetic attempts at the introduction of a sliding work week, the seven-day week with work-free Sunday could not be eliminated even in communist states with an atheist worldview. Tremendous power of this system to bring the Julian and Gregorian calendars to bear on the whole world. Even in communist states with an atheist worldview, even in atheistic circles and organizations throughout the world, the Christian holidays enjoy an undisputed popularity as work-free days. They have thereby undergone a process of striking desacralization, and especially Christmas, commercialization. The Christological foundation of Christmas was replaced by the myth of Santa Claus. End of quote from Encyclopedia Britannica, as they show how this system, they might as well quote Daniel 7:25, how this system would think to change times and laws. Back to Revelation chapter 17. I've covered some of this in the Who is the Devil booklet too, what God is going to do to this system. Back to verse 15, chapter 17, 15. And he said unto me, the waters which you saw where the whore sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, the biggest religion on earth. There are more Catholics and more if you count the daughters, then you double that roughly, perhaps. That'd be a fair number, I would guess, than any other religion on earth, by far. Verse 16, and the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire, for God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will. You know, if you talk to some Catholic theologians and historians, they will tell you freely and openly, it's written, they understand this whore is them. They know that. I've read sources as much as 30-some years ago. They acknowledge it. They just say, but it's the church in a degenerate condition because Christ gave the keys to Peter. Peter was the first pope, so we know it's not a pretty picture being called by God a great whore, and it's us, but we're it. We're the church. That's why they can stand up as they did 3 months ago and say, we are the only path to salvation, and believe it. I'll make her desolate, naked, shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to do his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. You cannot miss that if you open your Bible. There's no doubt which city reigns over the kings of the earth. It's Rome. There's no mystery there at all. Verse 10 of the next chapter, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is her judgment come. Verse 17, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company in ships and sailors, and as many as trade by sea, stood afar off as she's destroyed, and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, that great city wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. In a very short period of time, she is destroyed. You can read in much greater detail the destruction of that system in Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51, the whole chapters. How bad is Christmas, brethren? Christmas is Babylon. It's the system of Babylon. Whether or not people keep Christmas has never been the sole question. It is whether or not you've come out of Babylon, the great system, and whether or not one has done that is the great question. Once you have come out of Babylon, of course you will come out of Christmas. It's a whole system. I saw false leaders stand up and say early in the last decade that they felt cheated at Christmas time. They wanted to go backward, but they forgot to go far enough backward to see where it came from or to see where keeping it leads to. And most of the people of God, if they were ever converted, and most of them obviously probably were not, have gone back to the things we've described in this sermon. Final verse, John chapter 17. John 17. And verse 9. John 17 and verse 9. Christ is praying, I pray for them. I pray not for the world. Well, that makes sense, what we read back there in Jeremiah. Don't pray for the world. Christ doesn't pray for the world. But for them which you have given me, for they are yours, and all mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I am glorified in them. And now I am no more in the world. Christ didn't halt between two opinions, sort of in the world, sort of not. But these are in the world. And I come to you, Holy Father, keep through your own name those whom you have given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in your name. Those that you gave me I've kept, and none of them is lost but the son of perdition, Judas, that the scripture might be fulfilled. And now come I to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they might have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them. Now that's just a plain fact for true Christians. It just is, brethren, because they are not of the world. And I would simply add, not of the system of Babylon of this world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. That's the lesson, brethren, that we ought to be focusing on in the Christmas season. This is the season when Babylon best shows its wares. We have come out of it. Let's always remember to stay completely out of it for the rest of our lives.